Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect Podcast. I'm Ellen Halliday, Deputy Editor at Prospect, and today I'm joined by Tom Clark, who is a contributing editor at Prospect, to discuss the collapse of local councils and what a Labour government might do about it. This is a really live issue. Last year, three councils in England went bust: Nottingham, Birmingham, which we'll come to, and Woking, joining Thurrock and Croydon, which went bust the year before. The BBC's political research unit has reported that one in five councils have warned of effective bankruptcy within 5 years unless there is reform. So a little while ago, Tom set out to investigate just what's going on and what lies ahead. Tom, it's lovely to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Ellen. Nice to be here.
So looking at that picture around us, Birmingham, Nottingham, Woking and the others, and that warning about the future, has there ever kind of been a time like this for councils?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly not within my memory, and I suspect probably not ever, to be honest. I mean, in terms of these, what people call, slightly misleading, but they call them bankruptcy notices, we can talk about maybe what they really mean. There were none given between the year 2000 and the year 2018, so 18 years with none. And then in the last 6 years, we've had eight councils put them out and two councils have put out more than one, I think. So you've kind of gone from none to eight. And then, you know, you had a figure there with the BBC reporting that as many as a fifth of councils are saying they might have to do something. The local government research unit, their own serving, they found half of councils are saying within 5 years they might have to put one out. So that gives you a sense of how general it is. It could be kind of everywhere that people are waving up their hands and saying to the government, we can't pay the bills, tell us what to do.
I mean, as you say, it's sort of effective bankruptcy. So council can't literally go bankrupt, but rather there's something called a Section 114. Is that right? Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, the Section 114 is, I think, a better analogy from the corporate world is what people call when a company goes into administration, the management recognises it can't pay the debts as things stand, and then it's handed over to administrators who have a singular fixation on, you know, doing whatever they have to do, selling assets, for example, closing down, you know, if you think of a chain of shops, they might close down some abruptly and keep the other ones that are making a profit going, pay the debts. And then if the debts get paid, maybe the management will get control back, and if they don't and they can't pay the debts, then it moves into, you know, proper bankruptcy and insolvency. And the real analogy here is that just like debtors are able to look to administrators to run the company in place of the regular management, after a council like Birmingham puts up one of these 114 notices, then Whitehall can appoint these people, these officers, who kind of come in and kind of jointly take decisions with the council to see that bills are paid. And, you know, the thing that I think is really frightening and could be a scandal very soon is that these people, let's call them administrators, you know, their job is simply to see that these bills are paid. So they're not taking a long-term view about what services need to be like in the area. They're just saying, okay, well, let's sell this library off, and if necessary, let's sell it off at cut price to make sure we get some cash in quickly to pay these bills. And, you know, there's a obvious problem with that which is that you can only sell forever assets to pay this year's bills kind of once. It's not a trick you can keep repeating. But then, you know, if you've got things like institutions and things that have taken a while to build up and you rip them away, you need to be in a very strong position to rebuild them. You know, it's not just a case that, like, you can close a swimming pool and a library and all of these kind of things and then assume that you can reopen them the next year, because if they've turned into something else or been knocked down, they're not there.
So councils are kind of in a pretty dire financial situation and looking around, as you said, to assets that they wouldn't previously have considered selling for funds. But just in terms of numbers, what is the level of funding gap that councils are now facing? Is there a sum that we can point to?
Maybe the best way to think of it is in terms of what is the decline. You know, we've had all these long years of austerity. What's the decline in the purchasing power of town halls up and down the country? And Tony Travers, the LSE expert on local government, said the best number to use is just about a fifth. You can see higher numbers. You can see 27%, I think it is, that the Local Government Association have got. There's some figures I've seen that say that it's now a bit less than a fifth because, you know, Michael Gove's introduced various emergency bailouts in the last couple of years. But it's of that kind of order, a real terms cut of a fifth. And that's made up of getting on for a half cuts from the grants that central government gives to local government, ameliorated then a little bit by the fact that revenue from, say, council tax has continued to go up. And that's where you come out at something like a fifth. Now, how big is a fifth over, you know, 12, 13 years? It's quite big. Let's compare it to the NHS. The NHS in the last 10 years has seen a real terms increase in spending, believe it or not, for all the problems there, of about a third. So a cut of a fifth. And remembering that councils have got these huge responsibilities for old and frail people who need social care, just like the NHS, of course, does, makes you realise why probably councils are in an even worse state than the NHS that maybe there's more reporting on.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, perhaps not some Prospect listeners who, you know, read a lot around this subject, but a lot of people will be really surprised by that NHS figure. And as you say, we hear a lot about, rightfully, the pressure on NHS resources. Why do you think it is that people talk less and you know, including ourselves in the media, talk less about the challenges facing councils?
Well, they're very, it's in the nature of them that they're very diffuse. You know, the media, of course, has got much more centralised. Local papers aren't the force that they were. They employ many fewer people, and national media is correspondingly more important. And its centre of gravity is, of course, national. I mean, there's a sort of deeper problem that goes back to like the early 80s, I think, which is that, you know, there's been a lot of the funding for local government, even now after all this austerity, is still coming from the centre. So half or so of the funding is central. So there's a sort of sense that local management doesn't change that much, that a lot of what local councils have to do in terms of, you know, particularly social care, it's really the national government that determines what it tells local government to do. So there's a sort of general sense maybe that it doesn't matter as much, you know, or at least there's not as much political drama, fateful political drama going on in local councils as there is elsewhere. But, right, there are things that all of us notice on our high streets, or like in travelling to our high streets, like getting a bus, like seeing if there's a library that we can take our kids to, like whether there's a swimming pool we can take our kids to. All of these things that are not protected services in the same way that social care are, they are the kind of small chunk that councils have got to play with when they face these difficult circumstances, which means that the cuts are absolutely brutal. So, for example, already by the end of the 2010s, a third of the libraries in England had closed. Now, you know, I can't think of any other public service where, you know, we've actually seen that scale of cutbacks of whole institutions rather than, you know, trimming around the edges an hour and access and that kind of thing. And I think the huge thing, the political thing for Labour, is in whatever kind of vague sense, when we get what I'd fully expect, which is a very large swing against the Conservatives and probably a large Labour majority. The country will think it's voted for an end to this kind of public squalor. But as things stand, if they really stick to those fiscal rules, unless they let councils do something different from what councils are currently allowed to do, I don't see any prospect of the civic realm being restabilised. Because, you know, I know that there are councillors and councils who are waiting for a change of government, thinking that's going to change everything. But if we take Labour at face value and say it's only going to do the things it's saying it's going to do, much is going to change at all, which means that lots of those councils who are saying that they're just holding on for now will give up and teeter over the edge.
Absolutely love to come back to that in a little bit more detail later on. But it seems like this, you know, there's been a lot of discussion. A major theme of politics in recent years has been the kind of levelling up agenda. And you talked there about councils being more, you know, diffuse in the NHS and the kind of experiences people have with the services immediately around them just vary massively across the country from council to council. So how does this conversation about councils fit in with that conversation we've been having, you know, quite often about levelling up in politics over recent years?
One thing I found out, because I know, you know, I'm not up in the north of England now, and I've been speaking to some people in the north, and they were very much hoping that, like, actually, we know that Boris Johnson kind of saw himself as putting together this new coalition that was about the north, and there are things that have gone on in terms of, you know, towns funds and new strategic partnerships with, I don't know, like West Yorkshire Strategic Authority, North East Combined Authority, and different, you know, so there have been things that have gone on. But then we also know that when Rishi Sunak came in, very much, I mean, he's a Yorkshire MP, but he's very much a kind of figure of the South. And he went to a Tunbridge Wells fundraiser and told all these local activists, no doubt, including a number of councillors, that he'd got rid of the dodgy Labour business of trying to give too many grants to deprive local areas and ensure that it could be spread around with places like Tunbridge Wells instead. And so, like, there is a suspicion, and you see this in the urban north, that people think, oh, that's great, we'll just retilt the scales even if there's not much more money. But one thing I really learned in doing this article is that it's very unlikely that's going to work. And I was reminded by Tony Travers of 18 months ago, less than 18 months ago, the leaders of Kent Council and Hampshire Council. So, you know, the kind of, you know, I don't know if they've actually got knighthoods, these people, but the Knights of the Shires kind of thing, figuratively, they'd written to the government and saying, if you don't bail us out, you know, because of these pressures on care costs and all the rest of it, we're going to fall over. So, you know, the idea that there's some easy kind of retilting of the scales that can go on, I think, is awry. So, I mean, one telling example, I think, of this national problem that's playing out in disparate ways in disparate places is in, you know, Kent County Council's 200-year-old listed headquarters, Sessions House. I think it's in Maidstone. No doubt some listener in Kent will tell me if I've got that wrong. But it's on the market at the moment. You know, does someone want to turn it into a hotel or whatever? As if the kind of public square itself is no longer affordable. And that's in the Shires, right? Two points I take away from this. First of all, there's no easy way of kind of levelling some people up without kind of doubling down on pain that's everywhere, because the pain's already everywhere. It's not about levelling up, it's about bulldozing down. That's the state we're in at the moment. Secondly, you know, because there are these individual landmarks, individual things that are closing in different places through a plethora of local decisions that maybe don't make the national news, maybe we're not joining the dots. You know, if the country's in a mood where it's expecting things to change, I think it could become more of a national story than it's become so far.
Of course, it was big news last year when Birmingham Council went bust, which is Europe's largest local authority, serves more than a million people. And so the impact, it would be absolutely huge on a very large community. And every council will have a slightly different financial story. But can you talk a bit about what the story was with Birmingham, which you've kind of told in your piece, and what that reveals about the moment that we're now in?
Yeah, I mean, what I thought I'd do here is wind back to the very beginning, if you like, of municipal English government. I think it was the 1830s or 1840s when, like, municipalities got, like, anything like what we'd recognise as a modern council, but no one really did anything very creative with those powers for a while. And the point where they did begin to do something creative with it was the early 1870s. And you have Joseph Chamberlain, a controversial figure who did all kinds of things, good and bad, over the course of a long career. But in the early 1870s, he kind of took Birmingham City Council, well, it wasn't yet a city, it was a town corporation or whatever, by storm. And, you know, he had this promise that he was going to kind of like create parks, improve, create assizes, which I think is an old fashioned word for court, and just generally kind of turn around the borough, which he then did. So he got in and he dealt with something else with kind of a weird echo of today. He dealt with kind of failing utilities by buying up on behalf of the council the local water board, cleaned up the water, cleared lots of slums, and planned and rearranged the shopping street. So you've still got Corporation Street that people in Birmingham still be familiar with, laying out a new centre. And in those areas, life expectancy went up very quickly, which had been very low. He also then used all this in a few years, the council's purchasing power to buy up the local gas board. And the gas board made a profit for the council, and the profit was part of the reason he was then able to expand things like the local art gallery and local parks. And so, you know, it was seen, Birmingham, as the cradle of modern municipal governance at that time. A few years later, Joseph Chamberlain's in the House of Commons agitating in the 1880s and successfully getting a sort of rationalised system of nationwide local government from 1888, I think it is, onwards, creating all the county councils, some of which would go on to do interesting things, you know, like the London County Council in the 1930s with transport and with other things. So all of this kind of history of active municipal governance can be traced back to Birmingham in the 1870s. And so it's poignant now to see that as Birmingham realises, and the particular triggers for it were specific, it had mishandled historic claims about unequal pay and that kind of thing. But really, the underlying frailty is the one that we've been talking about, shared with all the other councils. And I just saw the BBC News story and the list of things that they were doing. They're cutting the arts budget by 100%. They are closing a dozen or so community centres, completely closing them. The other thing they're doing is they're cutting the number of people who are keeping an eye on fly tipping. So I just thought, you know, less music, less art, less community and more rubbish on the streets. You know, we can see quite directly that's what's going to flow from these decisions, which is a kind of reverse version of what Joseph Chamberlain did so successfully in the 1870s. And so the question that makes you think is this place that was the cradle of creative local government in England also going to be its grave?
After the break, we'll talk more about the crisis in local authority budgets. But first, I'd like to tell you about a special spring offer. Support the prospect of a better future with our 25% off spring sale. Prospect is a stronghold of independent and unbiased journalism, needed now more than ever this global election year. Contribute to a society driven by informed dialogue and constructive debate. Subscribe to Prospect with our limited 25% discount at www.prospectmagazine.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Okay. That contrast is extremely stark, and I would sort of wonder when that shift took place from this kind of attitude of innovation and building up the city to what now feels like has been many years of decline in not just in Birmingham but across the country in investment in these kinds of services. I mean, was there like a turning point, or how do we explain the difference between that attitude and Joseph Chamberlain's approach at the very beginning and this quite bleak picture that we now face?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I think, you know, it's important to recognise that there have been periods of challenge before, even if there's not been anything quite like this. The late 1970s saw a lot of retrenchment. You know, people would know about the IMF crisis in the mid-1970s, and there was a lot of retrenchment in council services then, again into the early 80s and the Thatcher years. And it always felt like, you know, when I was growing up, there was always a feeling of retrenchment, cutbacks and compulsory competitive tendering, and town halls saying they wanted to be able to do more things, build more council houses, but they'd sell things under right to buy, and the central government would swipe the revenue and say, no, you're not having that to build more houses, we want it for something else down south. And so that lots of those problems are familiar. And then there were the good times where, like, there was more creative expansion, and some people would say on the right, people would say there was more waste, and there probably was some more waste around the edges. And then the kind of period of kind of tightening the screws after 2010. But I don't think it led to an immediate cry. You know, there were ways of doing things differently. There were layers of middle management and so on that you could take out that wouldn't immediately sort of decimate services. But there's just this feeling that, like, the last 5 years or so, as these bankruptcy notices, so-called, start to be issued, that you're into a different realm now where people are just saying, we can't make decisions, we can't chart a different course through. Because in parallel, and this is different, I think, from the past, you've got more and more things that councils really are legally obliged to provide. So I think it's 2014, there's legislation improving, and we'd all welcome this, you know, improving the rights of people with disabled kids to get access to various services and people transport and that kind of thing. But if that's a promise made by a national government that's not matched by local resources, it ends up just making the arithmetic more dicey, and probably those promises aren't always bankable. And so it's that kind of pincer movement, I guess, between rising obligations on very vulnerable people, be they old or be they young, on the one hand, and remorselessly declining resources on the other, which I think probably is new, because I think, you know, in 1981, I don't think Margaret Thatcher was saying you've got to do this or the other extra for vulnerable people in your community.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important point, again, that is perhaps not as widely known as it should be, that councils have to make cuts in certain areas because in other areas they simply cannot. And one of those areas is social care. So, I mean, the King's Fund has said demand for adult social care is now at a record high. Requests reached almost 2 million people last year, and councils are spending kind of the vast majority of the budgets that they now have on those services that they're legally obliged to provide that are important, but it doesn't leave much left over.
And I think, you know, it's a sort of, there's a broken kind of ecology here, because, you know, you can see why there's case law and there's reforms and so on that give people increasing rights. We want to give disabled people, and particularly children who need special services. We want to give them increased rights. But if you impose those rights on councils without the resources, then you might, for example, mean you've got to close a Sure Start centre over here that might have prevented someone needing some emergency children's care later that's more expensive. And you might mean that a council has had no obligations and can neglect a child until it suddenly needs to be put in residential care. And then suddenly it's got a legal obligation where it's really got to meet this child's need all at once. But there might only be five accredited centres within 100 miles that can provide the care that the child needs. And then you get a kind of panic buying thing where the price of those places that the council's obliged to provide are bidded up because there's four other town halls in a similar situation. And so it's a kind of broken ecology where you get impossible needs of the ageing society. You get increasing rights for children and young people, enforceable in the courts, combined with inadequate resources. And it has all these perversities where it ends up with prices going up and maybe profits, maybe even in this scarce environment. Some people are thought to be profiteering from all of this.
All of this leaves a lot of questions for the next government. If the polls are correct, as you say, we will be having a Labour government having to look at all of these questions and find some answers. What kind of position does that leave them in politically?
Well, what I want them to understand is how vulnerable they are. That's the first thing, because people will, in whatever kind of grudging way, you know, however downbeat their mood music is, people kind of think from their whole life experience that, like, Labour's going to come back. They remember it wasn't austerity with Labour before, and maybe it won't be austerity with Labour now. And as I've tried to underline, like, there are a lot of people just holding on, and it could be a very visible form of deepening, not steady, but deepening austerity if nothing changes. Because it could be that, you know, even if the media don't cover it, if, like, the one library that's in your neighbourhood is closed, the two swimming pools that are in your neighbourhood close, and the bus services are halved or whatever, people will really notice that, right? Because it's just visible decay of the public realm on their streets. And if that happens, it's a catastrophe, I think, for Labour with the voters. Labour is already potentially on watch with a lot of its activists and councillors, the backbone of the party that's going to need to carry it through what could be a bumpy first term. They're fed up with the leadership's caution on a whole range of things. But they are thinking, well, at least we'll get something done about these councils that we're running. And the mood there, you know, these are the absolute stalwarts of the local Labour parties, will completely sour if they get in and they've got a budget which is even worse than they've had so far. And that is the logic of these spending plans that Jeremy Hunt has made, knowing he won't have to impose and he's going to leave for Rachel Reeves to mete out, you know. And then even if Rachel Reeves puts up taxes, as she will do in some kind of underhand way, which hasn't been announced before the election, you know, because they'll have to, as Labour did in 1997, it's not obvious that councils are going to be the top priority because they're going to have to stop the health service falling over. They're saying they're going to have to do things on defence. You know, there's all kinds of things that they're going to have to do all over the place. So it looks pretty dicey. It really does look dicey. And I just think the first thing I want to say is wake up to this and then think creatively, because, you know, like, this could really sink any sense of national renewal quite quickly.
All of this leaves a lot of questions for the next government. If the polls are correct, as you say, we will be having a Labour government having to look at all of these questions and find some answers. What kind of position does that leave them in politically?
I think if they do increase tax, you know, like when Labour got in 1997, they axed something called the refundable dividend tax credit. No one knows what that is and no one can remember now, but it brought in £5 billion that no one had seen coming or something, I think, every year from company pension schemes. And maybe they've got some things like that up their sleeve. But if they do, they're going to want to use them for managing emergencies that fall directly on Keir Starmer and perhaps for doing something about the health service, right? I think before they get to worrying about town halls. So they need to think of some way to let councils do something to get more revenue for themselves. I don't think you can just say, we'll put up the council tax. At the moment, there's a limit on how far council can put up the council tax. But at the moment, that's really difficult because the council tax is absurd. It's based on very out-of-date property valuations. And it's increasingly regressive now. There's no, you know, the coalition abolished the safety net thing to make sure the poorest people don't have to pay it. So, you know, it's already going up fast. It's going up right now this month. And it would be very painful to put that up more. So I think what they need to do is they might come up with some small things around the edges that could help in some places. A good example maybe is tourism taxes. Lots of cities around the world impose little tax. If you stay on a hotel in Paris or something, on Rome, I think you pay, you know, a few euros here or there that goes straight to a town hall. But that isn't going to be the national answer. I think what they want to do is try and link it with one of their so-called missions around house building and planning and say, councils are making decisions, and they might be quite tough decisions, about giving up some land to be built on. That will be unpopular. It will be controversial with a lot of local voters. It will affect the amenity of the views from some people's houses. It's inherently a community-wide decision to build those houses. At the moment, though, the great financial gain from that decision is overwhelmingly often accrues to people, whatever lucky farmer happened to own the field where the houses are built. Because, you know, you can have in the southeast of England a field that might be worth X thousand pounds, and then a decision comes that we're going to build on that, and it's suddenly worth 20 times as much or something like that, a huge increase in land. And I think the only way I can sort of see that something that councils are involved in is to rejig the planning system so that that windfall, you know, as much of it as possible accrues to the council instead. That's the principle I think we need to get to. That would help Labour with the politics of, you know, I think Labour's got no idea how difficult this politics of planning is going to be. I think they've got a sort of rather London-centred view of it at the moment. And in lots of Middle England, it's going to be really painful. But if they could say, well, this is going to mean that, like, we're building these houses, and the consequence of that is that your council's going to get a load more money, which is going to allow it to keep the library open and keep the buses running or whatever it is, then that could change the politics. And so you could be solving those two problems at once. I mean, that's the principle.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned taxes. Is that the basis of what you would assume Labour's plan to be to tackle this crisis? Or do we know about anything else, any other policies that they're thinking of to address it?
You know, I think all the options are pretty tough for an incoming government at the moment. And, you know, I think whatever they do and however they sugar the pill in places like where I am here in West Yorkshire, you know, nothing motivates people and gets people more wound up than a sense that there's unplanned development spoiling their views and all the rest of it. And the pressure on the infrastructure and all the rest of it. It motivates people much more than the idea of a Labour tax bombshell or 5p on income tax over here. You know, like, and I think that just because it hasn't been a political dividing line before, they're underestimating it. And people keep talking about the 1992 election and Labour said it would do this or that on tax and then it turned out to go wrong. Or, you know, just because we haven't tried this one before, everyone got scared off it, doesn't mean it's not going to be hugely, explosively difficult. And I find it bizarre that they can be so cautious on so many other things and so complacent on this, that Keir Starmer will actually talk about bulldozing through planning regulation. I just think it's crackers. But given where they are, right, given the fact that they need to, you know, the tax burden is very high, separate from the particular problems with council tax, the country's not in a mood where it wants to pay loads more tax. It is in a mood where it is very concerned that services that people rely on, public transport, NHS, all the rest of it, are collapsing. It is looking to Labour to do something about it. And there is a sense that everything's been a bit stagnant for too long. There's lots of young people who are going to be stuck in rentals as things stand forever. Labour's taken a risk, at least at the general rather than the specific level, by saying it will do something about housing. And that hasn't so far, I think, because it's not got specific yet, but it hasn't so far dented its popularity. And given that it's not saying much else about what it will do elsewhere. It I think needs to then follow through and find a way of making this work. And yeah, it might need to say, you know, we've opened the books, they're worse than we thought. Every town hall in Britain's going to be under the water in 2 years' time if we don't do something drastic. You know, so you might need to do a bit of Project Fear, maybe justify Project Fear given the arithmetic we've been talking about, and then say, but there is this way out. We can squeeze these developers who we're going to need to build these houses. And yes, of course, they'll make a reasonable return, but we don't want the landlords, who after all are doing nothing more than just sat there and owning land, to get the fruits of the new growth that we're hoping to generate. So, I mean, you know, it's difficult, but politics, things get to the political level when they are difficult. And I think, you know, there's technical things that can be done, and you can sense that something needs to give here from the fact that the Tories and Michael Gove have been looking at changes, and they've made some changes so that in principle councils could compulsorily buy more land to build council houses on, for example. None of them have got the money to do any of that at the moment, but, like, you know, they've got the new option there. Labour's sort of talked about the idea that you could change the way you value land for compulsorily buying it, so that you don't say the hope value, you know, the chance that this might be built on later is factored into the price that the council pays. So in that case, the council could say, we're buying this field from you as an agricultural field. We're using our power as a council to change it into buildable land. Oh, look, it's gone up 20 times in value, and now we'll sell it on. With that money, then we've got something where we can start to heal the civic realm. And the final twist in the argument I would make to Labour is that, you know, I worked last year on this project with the Resolution Foundation about getting the growth rate up of the country, shared prosperity and all of that nice sounding stuff that Labour talks about. And, you know, one of the big things, coming back to our theme of the day, Birmingham, was that Birmingham, along with Manchester, needed to be kind of engines of growth for a sort of service, exportable services that can create really high paying and also therefore high tax paying jobs that can start to get the country moving again. How do you create a humming service economy? You make a local environment that's attractive to lots of the people who are good at producing local services in law, accountancy, advertising, whatever. And how do you do that? You make a great place to live. And what you definitely don't do is allow fly tipping and cut the arts budget by 100% and sort of assume people are going to turn up anyway. So I think there's that kind of sequencing thing in terms of kickstarting their ambitions on growth that mean this could be a way to tie a few things together.
Tom, are there any other potential fixes, potential ideas that we should talk about before we wrap up?
One thing that obviously needs to happen is, I think it's totemic. I don't think Labour can, I think it's ruled out ending the so-called right to buy of council houses. But what it can do is it can massively cut back to the point of nearly eliminating the subsidies. So at the moment, if you want to buy your council house, you get, you know, some very large discount off the market value. And as a result, a lot of people buy them and the council is then shortchanged and doesn't have the resources to build new houses because it's lost an asset that's worth more than the money it's got back. So that would be a fairly big lever, I think, it could pull.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for giving us the context that we're looking at and giving us a bit of a sense of what Labour could possibly do to deal with this really big problem that it's going to be facing if it does indeed win the next election. So thanks very much for joining.
Thanks, Ellen, and fingers crossed for town halls across the country.
That's all for now. Thanks so much to Tom for joining us, and thanks to our listeners at home for tuning in. If you enjoy this podcast, then head to our website at prospectmagazine.co.uk or to our app, where you can read Tom's excellent piece, as well as Peter Kellner's analysis of the latest polls, Sophia Smith-Gaylor on how AI could bring African languages online, plus much, much more. Goodbye for now, and see you next time.